welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Today's topic is Moore's Law, Dead or Alive. With me today is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna.
Good morning, Dan.
And our guest, my favorite semiconductor historian, Dr. Walden Rhines.
Good morning, Daniel. Good to be here.
The most talked about semiconductor phenomenon, in my opinion, is Moore's Law. Wally, can you give us a brief history of Moore's Law to get us started?
Sure. And Moore's Law has been so important to the industry because it's been something that people believed in enough that it caused us to try to achieve it as much as it was a predictor. 1965, Electronics Magazine, Gordon Moore published the article. He had given it at a Electrochem Society speech. He took four data points, put them on a plot, and they represented the number of components in the largest of integrated circuits that had been introduced at that time. When you drew the straight line, it came out doubling the number of components every year, and that became Moore's Law for a while. And then later, it had to be adjusted to every 2 years. And after that, it came back to 18 months and moved around. So it never really was a law, but it was something that gave us a guidepost. And the guidepost was the doubling in density every cycle. That means you shrink the size of the chip linearly by 70%. 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.49. That means it's half the size it was before. Now you can put in twice as many transistors, and we're off and running. But Gordon himself said, no exponential is forever, and that's certainly true of Moore's Law. It's becoming less relevant all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that Moore's Law was published in 1965, and Intel wasn't founded until 1968. So a lot of people tie Moore's Law and Intel together, but that's not necessarily the case. Of course, Gordon Moore, you know, was one of the founders of Intel, but Moore's Law predates them, right?
Well, that's not an accident. Intel has certainly done its share of promotion of Moore's Law.
Thank you, Wally. Now let's talk about FinFETs. Moore's Law seemed to hit the FinFET wall pretty hard. Intel first came out with FinFETs at 22 nanometer in 2011, which followed the Moore's Law two-year process cadence nicely. Intel 14 nanometer came 3 years later in 2014, but had serious yield challenges for the next year or so, which was documented on semiwiki.com. Intel 10 nanometer started shipping in 2019, which was 5 years later, and again with yield challenges. Intel 7 nanometer with EUV was planned for this year, which is probably not going to happen. And Intel 5 nanometer was planned for 2024, but that's also in serious doubt. What do you think happened here, Wally? Did FinFETs kill Moore's Law?
No, I think Moore's Law was already yielding to the death of the exponential. And FinFETs overcame a different problem. That was that shrinking alone would lead to power dissipation that was untenable. And the FinFET was a very low leakage component, and that helped offset the issues that increased power dissipation was having.
You're absolutely right, Wally. The next big Moore's Law disruption, in my opinion, came from the fabless ecosystem when Apple partnered with TSMC at 20 nanometer. Apple requires a new process every year without fail for their fall iProduct launches. Just looking back, you know, when Intel did 14 nanometer, they did both double patterning and FinFETs at the same time, which caused them problems. TSMC, however, took the cautious step of adding double patterning to 20 nanometer, then adding FinFETs and calling it 16 nanometer. Since then, TSMC has moved to a yearly process cadence, which I call half steps, you know, from 20 nanometer to 16, to 12, to 10, to 7. And at 7 nanometer, TSMC added a half step of EUV for a 7 nanometer plus node. After that, 5 nanometer had full EUV, and it was followed by 4 nanometer and 3 nanometers coming up, all FinFET based. At 2 nanometer, however, it will be gate all around technology, so that will start a whole new era of device level innovation.
Yeah, I think one of the things you're pointing out is the terminology and the naming became very fuzzy with time. So what one company calls 16 nanometer, TSMC, others call 14 nanometer, we get to 10 and it's confused and overlaps with 7 and so on. And the tie to density has virtually disappeared. For example, TSMC, when it announced that 3 nanometer was going to be available and that there would be risk production in 2021 and mass production in 2022, their numbers said that it would be a 70% density increase, not a doubling, just the next node. And the things you're talking about, I think, reflect several things. One is that TSMC chose its steps judiciously and, as it turns out, very effectively, not taking too big a step, but not too small a step. And so as they brought in EUV, they did it cautiously. As they made the transition to each new technology, they did it in such a way that it could be assimilated, yields could be achieved, and people would have sufficient time to design new products to take advantage of the shrinking features.
Well, TSMC certainly changed how we do process launches, which added a lot of yield learning that brought us shorter ramps and record-setting yield for new processes, which ultimately means lower chip costs. The good news is now that Moore's Law is less relevant, we have found other ways to innovate to further reduce semiconductor costs.
Yeah, that's right, Daniel. In fact, if you go back to the original history, there's been some written about the fact that Moore's Law, as it turns out, was an empirical observation that reflected a very fundamental evolution of the industry, and that was the learning curve. We know that the cost per transistor has come down a linear learning curve since 1954. If you plot the log of the cost per transistor versus the log of the cumulative number of transistors ever produced. And that learning curve is still constant today. We can predict, in fact, what's going to happen to cost-effective integrated circuits in the future simply by looking at the learning curve. What's interesting is that, as it turns out, Moore's Law was a coincidental reformatting of the learning curve. That is, when all of the cost reduction is done through shrinking feature sizes and growing wafer diameters, then Moore's Law and the learning curve are exactly the same. And that's really what was reflected over all those years. The learning curve stayed constant, and as long as Moore's Law was benefiting from shrinking feature sizes, then the learning curve and Moore's Law both predicted the future. Now we're sort of beyond that. Moore's Law is an exponential with time. It can't continue, but the learning curve can, because it's the logarithm of cumulative units produced. So we know that in the future, while it may not be cost effective to shrink feature sizes at the rate we have in the past, it will be cost effective to do many other things. And those things include improvements in packaging and wafer stacking and all sorts of other technologies that will keep us on the learning curve, even though Moore's Law will have gone by the wayside.
You know, Wally, as I listen to this discussion, it occurs to me that Moore's Law has been something of a safety net over the years. Yeah, the process development folks have been busy innovating, and the design community has benefited by basically going to the next process node and getting a kick in density and performance. Now that Moore's Law is slowing down, I agree with you that innovation will continue, but it's going to come from a different place now. It's going to come the old-fashioned way at the architectural level with innovations in multiple dimensions, things like parallelism, 2.5 and 3D integration, AI algorithms, purpose-built accelerators. Frankly, with a palette of innovation like that, I can't wait to see what happens next. I think it's going to be really interesting.
You're right, Mike. The fact is that just shrinking feature sizes doesn't do it anymore. You need innovations in other parts of the ecosystem. So the things you highlight, the ability to devise clever architectures to achieve higher performance and to stack wafers on top of each other. We're looking at a learning curve now that's dominated by flash memory, and that's clearly made it to 128 layers. And my friends in the memory business tell me it'll go to 512 layers. So when you buy that same package that looks like the same flash you bought a decade ago, all of a sudden you've increased the number of bits in that package by orders of magnitude. And that's kept us on the learning curve. That's kept the cost per transistor coming down. But it's meant that a lot of innovation had to occur from packaging people, design people, and others. And that's a different mode than when we could just turn to Moore's Law and say, here are the design rules for the next node. Go use them to design the best device you can.
A good example of innovating outside of Moore's Law is the Apple SoCs that power our phones and tablets and watches and now even laptops. Over the last 13 years, Apple has gone from a few million transistors on a die to many billions for the iPhone and iPad products. For example, the Apple 7 nanometer SoC had 10 billion transistors on a 135 square millimeter die. The next Apple SoC is 5 nanometer, which is what is in the current Apple products. It has about 12 billion transistors on a much smaller 88 square millimeter die. So that's, you know, this half node step brought consumers 20% more transistors and a 35% die reduction.
And absolutely, the people I talk to who design chips like Apple, tell me there is no limit to the number of transistors they can use on a single chip. When I say, does it stop at 100 billion? They say, well, if that's all we've got, then we'll go to multiple die, or we'll go to 2.5D or 3D stacking. But if we could get 200 billion, we know how to use them.
Yeah, so Apple's is at about 12 billion for the A14 on a single die. So let's talk about multiple die. Let's talk about chiplets. How does chiplets change things, Mike?
Chiplets is an interesting technology. I kind of view that as a step in the 2.5D direction, but a little bit more. There's been a lot of controversy around chiplets. Is it really going to do as much as some people think? But the concept of reusing proven bits of architecture, I think, is very powerful. You know, we've seen that a lot in analog mixed signal, where things stay at an older technology node because we know they work and it's problematic to get them to work at the next technology node. There's lots of things like that. So I feel like chiplets are a combination of keeping things that are understood and proven to remain that way in an integration palette that includes much more advanced technology. But it's also a way to increase density and to improve the overall form factor, because if they're not chiplets, they're separate chips. And boy, that's a whole lot worse from a density point of view. So there's a number of degrees of freedom, I think, that chiplets open up.
They really do. And I think the other thing they attack is design cost. So most designs that are done today are derivatives of existing designs. But one of the great frustrations of design is that when you do a new design, you have to re-verify the whole design. Even the things that you're taking directly from a previous design that were already working, when you extend that design by adding additional features, then all of a sudden you expose an additional state space, as we refer to it, and that means re-verification. With chiplets, you can talk about true modular design, where the interfaces are fixed and you simply add more functionality directly in the silicon, and then you only have to verify that functionality plus the existing blocks, and you have much less difficulty getting new variant designs out. You can do more designs with a given base design than you could if you had to do them all as ground up redesigns.
Yes, that's a really good point. I mean, it's one thing to have to re-verify the functionality of a billion transistors, if you will. It's a slightly simpler thing to say, well, I have a complex package with a bunch of chiplets and an interposer, and I got to make sure that everything's stable and connected correctly. That's a simpler problem to solve than the functionality problem, which is kind of taken care of with the chiplet, you know, known good die effect.
And one other thing is the fact that as we move to 3 nanometer and 2 nanometer, having a full reticle design and achieving high yield becomes more of a challenge. So frequently it may make more sense to divide things into multiple die, especially if you want to split process functionality between analog and digital, or draw the memory boundaries in other places. So having the flexibility to do that with smaller die, with chiplets, with 2.5D packaging, all of the chiplets or the die on a single substrate, gives another design flexibility that allows optimization of both cost and performance.
I agree. I think the way to say that is divide and conquer is very powerful. As I recall, one of the first 2.5D designs ever done was a Xilinx part, where literally they sliced up the huge die into two or three slices and put it on an interposer because it made the yield better, and it wasn't a whole lot more complicated than that, and they were off and running. So there's lots of reasons to do 2.5D.
Yeah, that Xilinx design was a lot of fun because they came to us at Mentor, and they wanted to do verification of the physical design. But when they put three different FPGAs in the same package, the physical verification overwhelmed the computers. And it was only then that we developed a scheme to simply verify the interfaces between the three die, rather than putting the whole netlist for all three die into a single computer run, which was clearly impractical.
Yep, 2.5D generated a lot of those divide and conquer strategies, so everybody adapted to it. But what I find interesting is the genesis of the first use of 2.5D was to solve a simple problem, nothing really, you know, that complex, but it was still very powerful and very significant and got the whole industry off and running.
Yeah, although these things have a way of reinventing themselves until they finally stick. So multi-chip modules were going to be a big thing about 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. Automotive companies even funded a lot of work to put analog and digital in the same package on different die. But all these things had to ultimately survive the test of yield and cost. And so there was an evolutionary path. Today, I look at RF components that have dozens of die in a single package. And we look at, as you're pointing out now, bigger and bigger digital die and multiple chiplets and 2.5D growing. But there was a path the industry had to follow to get there. And it wasn't always obvious that a multi-die version would come out with lower costs when you consider both the packaging costs and the relative yield and the inability to identify known good die easily. Those problems had to be overcome, and they largely are overcome today.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think about your comments about learning curve, and they ring true for me. I think it was starting about 2010. I predicted 2.5D would take off in a big way every year, and I was finally right, but it took a while for me to be right. It took a while.
Well, that's the good thing about semiconductors. You can be futuristic and you know you're going to be right eventually.
Exactly. Yeah. As we say, it's easy to predict the month of an introduction. It's hard to predict the year.
Absolutely. Also, I do get a kick out of the general feeling that we must have done all the innovating we're going to do, and we're consolidating down to a few big companies, and then new companies keep popping up as new technologies are introduced.
Dan and I have discussed that. That's the topic of future podcasts, but I think the whole artificial intelligence revolution is really driving a lot of that. You're having silicon that's allowing AI algorithms to run at real time with low latency, so they're actually useful. But now that you can do that, the ideas are just exploding of what you can do with that technology now that it runs fast enough to actually work in the real world. So we're seeing a lot of new startups there, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and a lot of general purpose neural networks, once they're trained and in broad use, are now going to end up as custom chips for specific applications.
Okay, let's wrap this up. Wally, can you give us just a brief look into the future?
So actually, if you go back to the fact that Moore's Law is just another way of expressing the learning curve, then it says we should go look at the learning curve for what's going to happen in 5 years. To do that, you have to predict how many transistors are we going to produce between now and 5 years from now. But you can make an intelligent guess there, since the number grows exponentially every year. And we look, and I think one of the things that stands out is that memory is moving down the learning curve faster than logic. So we're going to move to more and more memory intensive architectures that in fact, the percentage of memory transistors versus logic transistors has shown enormous increase since 1990, moving from about 50% then to about 98 or 99% now. And because we can add memory transistors less expensively than we can add logic transistors, the people who are doing these clever designs, like the neural network-based designs and dedicated AI applications, I think are going to continue to innovate those architectures to take advantage of the fact that memory is so much cheaper, and looking down the learning curve is staying well ahead of logic. So if you can do something in memory instead of logic, do it, because it's going to be a lot cheaper on a per transistor basis.
Well, I agree with you completely. An interesting point from my perspective is your comment about memory. AI algorithms are very hungry for memory. So I think that, there's a synergy there. That's one thing that personally excites me is the innovation and the creativity around artificial intelligence and what machines can do to literally act more like humans. And the algorithms, the ideas have been around a long time, but the delivery vehicle hasn't, and now it's here. So I'm really excited about seeing what happens in the future around that. That's not necessarily just a chip design innovation. It's a software and an architecture innovation, but at some point, I'm not sure you can tell the difference. Everything blends together.
Absolutely, Mike. And you know, it's amazing. The innovation continues even after the more than 60 years of an industry being available for innovation. It's exciting to me, and I'm looking forward to all the advances we're going to see in the next decade.
Okay, well, this is a good stopping point. Thank you very much, Wally, and thank you, Mike. Excellent content. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.